wrong with it? I want to be just like you. I want to be just like you. It's just a useless, everybody's equal thing.
Only Americans can come up with self-help books.
Yeah, that's true.
If you see a self-help book, it was probably written by an American. Mm-hmm. Okay, let's jump into this.
All right, then.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Narnia Whip Council. I am your host, Rillian, and today we have Dr. Elwyn Ransom with us. Hello, Doctor.
Hello, Rillian. How are you?
I'm doing pretty well. We're just about to jump into a nasty subject, though, so I'm a little apprehensive.
So it's not going to last. You're doing well.
You know what? I am above this movie. I refuse to let it damper me because I have a bottle of Jack Daniels right next to me. No, that's not true.
We have young listeners, sir.
That's true. I'm sorry. Well, that's true. That will be
let us try to be positive, especially because one of our more optimistic podcasting partners is not with us.
That's true.
But conversely, Glumpuddle was not able to make this one, and we are going to try to be fair.
We're going to try
to be balanced, and you can pick at us in the comment section on the forum after the podcast if you want to.
Yeah, we're going to try to be balanced. People have talked to me, how do you try to keep it balanced and stuff? And when you get a certain group of people, and Jim Van's kind of an exception to this, who have grown up reading the books, it makes the that all of a sudden is not representative of the Narnia Whip community, because a number of people were turned onto the books by the movies. Which is fine.
This is true.
But it all automatically creates different groups. So I've never tried to get a representative group. I've just always tried to get a group of people that will have good discussion. And this inevitably means people who will disagree with one another. You know, you can't really have as good a discussion when everyone feels exactly the same way and criticizes it. You know, C.S. Lewis said that you don't learn anything from people who think the same as you do. So,
yes. So, well, you've talked me into it, and now I'm just going to speak my full mind and let the chips fall where they may, to coin the phrase. And it's your fault.
It is. It is. Well, we're going to be talking about basically the Dark Island sequence. We're not going to cover the undragoning. For one thing, it'd just be messy because this scene intercuts with the undragoning. So to try to do it the way the film does would just be a mess. And also, it would just be a long discussion. So we're going to focus today just on the Dark Island. And we will be discussing the undragoning, hopefully, in the next podcast.
I look forward to that because we've got a few opinions on the undragoning, as some people may have guessed.
As does Glumpuddle.
As I'm sure you do.
Yes. Let's start off.
I think we all have the same opinions.
Yeah, and this is even in the last podcast, Jim Fan and I actually had some, except for the Reepy Cheep issue, some very similar views. So even if we had Jim Fan on here, there are lots of points where we would end up agreeing. You know, there's just some parts in the movie that are that way. So, starting off just on the edge of Dark Island, we discussed Jim Fan and I discussed the speech last time.
Caspian speech.
Yes.
His Braveheart rally to arms type speech.
Let's real briefly, you know, this is probably as good a place to do it as any. I was not a fan of how the script handled Caspian in this story. I mean, it wasn't terrible. It wasn't as horrible as some things, but it just didn't nothing impressed me. But overall, I liked Ben Barnes more as an actor in Voyage of the Dawn Treader than in Prince Caspian. He just seemed more at ease. I don't know if that was partly the accent. I don't know, but you know, I didn't really like the dialogue or the monologue of the speech, but I really did like the I really did like his acting. He seemed genuine. He seemed kind of like how I imagined Caspian.
I did too. Although the whole Caspian arc throughout the film, as many have said, was awkward. They weren't sure what to do with him at some points, which is fair enough, because in the book, you know, Caspian is just one of the characters is kind of along for the journey, going to these different islands. He doesn't have a development arc. He's the king of Narnia. The only time it really changes is at the very last, where we have the thing where he wants to go to the world's end, contrary to what they understand they're supposed to do.
Right.
They could have played that up a little bit more. They could have found some kind of different type of story for that. But as it was, I think that despite the weakness of the script in that area, Ben Barnes is just really hard not to like. I think for me, it helps to have known that he clearly is a genuine fan of the books, you know, unless he's just making everything up, which I 100% doubt in interviews where he talks about, you know, loving the books and, you know, he could have never known he'd get to play in the movies. And, you know, he was just went, what was it? He said, you know, he, along with a lot of people, went looking for worlds at the back of his wardrobe or something like that. Yeah. He comes across as genuinely dedicated. And I think it shows, even if he's giving a speech that's kind of weak and, you know, with some generic, you know, let's go out there and kick some tail for Narnia, you know, type stuff. I did like that last little bit there. I guess that'd be a sea serpent tale ultimately, but I did like the last little bit where he finishes off and he's a little uncertain and then everybody kind of does a rah, rah, rah anyway. And then he has this kind of expression like, hey, it worked. Uh-huh. I've only seen the film once, so I'm going off of that memory. And I just remember thinking maybe it was a little awkward and didn't fit with a whole lot else, but it did seem a bit original, mm-hmm. you know, as opposed to other movie moments where someone's rallying the troops and it's just pretty obvious. He's the born leader. He's the hero. He's meant to do this, and the troops are meant to go rah, rah, rah. Yeah.
Even the dialogue I didn't mind quite so much because, I don't know, I can imagine it kind of being awkward if we're just trying to come up with something like that. It's just that the speech he does give in the book at Ramandu's Island is so intelligent. But
yes. You mean to try to convince the ship's crew to go along with them?
Yes. Yeah, it's so intelligent there, which you don't get here. It's a different angle. But
The different angle is because they've changed a voyage to the edge of the world for adventure and honor, looking for an intrinsic beauty outside yourself. They've changed that into going around collecting swords, video game style, and picking up stuff.
And we will pick up on that in this episode. Okay, just some of the little pieces of dialogue, like when I'm just going to call her the MLG, when she says, yeah, someday I want to be just like you, and Lizzie, I want to be just like you, I feel bad when I'm looking through a movie and I'm trying to find things that I like, you know, and I'm like, okay, this isn't really so terrible, can't I like this? It's never a good sign for a movie when you come at it with that attitude, and that's just
trying to scavenge something, trying to salvage. Yeah. Like, well, that wasn't too bad. Yeah, that there, I think the one thing I think of is actually, I mean, can't help but go back to C.S. Lewis writing about subjects like this. He wrote, it wasn't in the Screwtape Letters, his satire, the letters between demons. He wrote an article. I think it was actually for an American magazine, in the same vein as Screwtape Letters. It was called Screwtape Proposes a Toast. And Screwtape is giving an address at a college graduation of demons, and he's an experienced one, so they call on him to give this speech, and he talks about how, hey, the one way that all these demons are going to win is by acting like everybody is the same. Nobody has different his gifts that someone else doesn't have. We're going to act like everybody is the same, and we're going to sell this as democracy. And that's a rather roundabout way of saying that this seems symptomatic of that. Lucy, Queen Lucy, is no better than the mysterious little girl. And let's just hammer that over people's heads. We're all the same.
Or at
in
least
one respect, yes. But another respect, this is Queen Lucy the Valiant here. You know, what exactly is it that it makes it necessary for her to say, I want to be just like you? What great character quality has the mysterious little girl shown? I don't know. I don't want to pick on the MLG, but that's what comes to my mind anyway.
Yeah. It's like okay, nice sentimental moment number three. I don't know. I have this image of you know, they're trying to come up with something and they have a box, a glass box, and break, you know, sentimental moments of pure genius, break in case of emergency. They say, no, 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 we might need that for the next film. But I don't know, little things like that. Okay, I do have a question. You know, when they're coming up to the island, you know, they say, what do you think is in there? The Dark Island. Mm-hmm. Our worst nightmares, mm-hmm. our darkest wishes, you know, pure evil. Is this the, I'm trying to remember, is this the first point where you hear that it might be dreams that come to life?
I don't think that was ever said before. Maybe someone who's gone and seen the film more than once could mm-hmm. clarify for us in the comments. I don't think it's ever been said before. It's just the green mist is going to tempt right. you. It's going to tempt you. It brings temptation. So if you're being tempted, look for green mist. It's tempting you.
I don't know if you do, but I remember my feeling as a little child. This was at the point in my life where I was still having nightmares. And I remember when the impact it when my father read that part of the book to me, and it just shocked me, because I thought, oh my goodness, let's see, I have the book right here in front of me. Lord Roop says, this is the island where dreams come true. And, you know, they go on to say, that's the island I've been looking for all this time. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd find Tom alive again. And then he says, do you hear what I say? This is where dreams, do you understand? Come to life, come real, not daydreams, dreams. And I remember as a little kid, I was freaked out. I thought that would be the worst place to end up.
Yes, and it's this genius twist on the idea of a place where dreams come true. No, because we don't only have happy dreams.
Yeah.
We have absolute horrible dreams that we would hate to see coming true. What was my dream last night? Last night I dreamed that I'd accidentally at some point gotten married to another woman and then divorced her and just completely forgotten about her. And she came after me and I thought, no, I love my wife now. Where'd this come from? How could I have missed that? I would hate to have that come true. Just melting out of green mist and floating at me on the ship's deck.
Yeah, I think that the film just lost so much terror because I had this image in my mind. Oh, they could play this so well. Imagine if mm-hmm. he gives that line of dialogue and then for about 5 seconds of, you just have a complete silence, you know? But it's like, but that would have to require subtlety, and that would be too much for this film.
Yes. Can I stop for a moment and just say, a positive note here. I did like the look of the Dark Island.
That was the next item on my list, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, there we go.
You see it?
Well,
there we go.
Think alike and all that. Okay. Yeah. So we're going to head into this thing and they say that, okay, here's at least three things that are inside, you know, mm-hmm. A, B, or C. It turns out the answer was D, all of the above. And yet it did look pretty cool.
Yeah. I mean, this is one of those things where, I guess I keep tying it back to the green mist, which they had earlier. But if I hadn't seen that, I think I might have liked it because it's what they describe. What Lewis describes in the book is so hard to do it well in a film. I mean, he basically describes it as the kind of darkness in a railway tunnel where you don't see the darkness; you just see light just stopping, and that's what it looked
mm-hmm,
like.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they may have considered that, and that maybe this is kind of what spawned the green mist. I don't know, but I can imagine why they would have wanted to give the island more personality, just visually. And yes. This is probably the best, one of the better ways to do it, to be honest.
I agree, and I wouldn't have minded some, you know, kind of the little neon green color in there. It looks very sinister. It looks, you know, like there's some kind of volcano at the middle of it spewing out this black stuff. My initial comparison, though, was based on many years of seeing Star Trek, The Next Generation episodes and films. It looks like exhaust fumes from a Borg ship. if anybody's seen those Borg cubes, they're all black and green. I mean, that's Borg green right there. And it looks like exactly what you'd expect to see coming out the exhaust pipe.
Oh, yes.
The Kohler correspondence made it seem creepier to me. I don't know, because, you know, the Borg are quite creepy.
Star Trek First Contact, one of my favorite science fiction of all time.
Oh, yes. It's got a few plot holes, but it's one of the best Star Trek films, for sure.
Yes, it is. Getting back to Voyage of the Dawn Treader.
I want to talk about good movies. Okay.
Oh, right. No. Life is not just pleasure. Christians may be the ultimate hedonists, but it has its limits.
That's true.
So, okay, this was one of those points where when they find Lord Roop, I was disappointed. And I know Glumpuddle was disappointed. The first thing they say when they see Lord Roop is, "Look, his sword!" That's the first thing they say. Now, Glumpuddle was just slapping his head at this point. Now, for me, of course, I had already been slapping my head at the point at Deathwater Island where they see this, and they quickly say, "Oh, the poor man, look, there's his sword." You know, oh, we don't really care about the person. We just want the sword. We don't really care about finding the Seven Lords anymore. We just want the swords, you know. And so at this point, Glumpuddle was slapping his forehead. I saw that, and I had already been trained by the movie because I knew what they were really looking for. They didn't care for the lords. I saw, oh, look, there's his sword, because that's all that we really care about by this point.
Again, it's like a video game. It's just run around up stuff. Yes, you're only trying to get to the end, and getting there is most of the fun, but the goal is just completely without purpose. And in this case, the give up the very values that they're supposedly upholding by searching for the swords to save the world. If you're saving the world, it means you're trying to save human lives. And if you really are trying to save human lives, then you're right. They're going to have some kind of compassion for this guy, you know, trapped in this horrible environment. And it becomes it's all plot and no characters, no sympathy, no nothing. Yeah. You can't empathize with this, you know?
Yeah. Well, and even watching it now, I loved the actor for Lord Roop. I thought he did it.
Yeah, I thought he was great.
The look, the makeup, the hair, his eyes. I thought he was really he was one of those characters that looked like he just jumped right out of the book. And I felt like the movie was kind of slapping him down. You know, it's like, even when I see him, it's like, "Look, I have a sword for you." You know, it's like, well, if I were fighting Mist all these years, I probably would have thrown that thing away. Kudos to you.
They didn't explain him very well either. What had he been doing that whole time? You know, some of that in the book is a mystery, but it looked like, do you remember, right? He was kind of on this, it looked like he was actually on this rock with there's nothing there.
Yeah, he's just on a rock, you know.
On a rock. Yeah.
Whereas in the movie, I mean, the book, in the book, it's like he, you know, he was just trying to swim away and he was trying to escape. You know?
No, that's right. He kept dragging him back.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I suppose he could be in that odd suspended animation, whatever parallel dimension thing that the Mist did to all the other people in their boats. So,
yeah. Plus,
that's later.
The book had the terrifying moment. Well, I'll bring this up later when we talk about the Albatross.
All right.
But we do have possibly we have a movie reference that comes up here. It's one of the best Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd films ever made, Ghostbusters.
I have not seen it.
You've not seen Ghostbusters?
I have not seen it. I see it referenced ad nauseum.
Let me recite a little moment to you, having just watched it. There is an evil an evil spirit who tells the four Ghostbusters, "You must choose the form of the Destroyer. Whatever you think of, that will come to fight you." And so one of them thinks of the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man, and so the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man appears as this giant figure to come. And of course, then they're like, "What did you do? Oh no, what did you think of?" And I'm watching The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I'm thinking, this is Ghostbusters. This is Ghostbusters. And I texted Glumpuddle. I was calling Glumpuddle. I said, I was thinking of Ghostbusters. I half expected to see the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man appear. And Gunbuttle said, if the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man had appeared in Voyage of the Dawn Treader, I would have given it 5 stars.
Admittedly, the serpent was quite nicely creepy, but surely someone would have noticed, hey, this kind of sounds derivative here, yeah. Fellas.
I mean, the whole dream idea, how do you think it came across? You know, starting at the beginning where people started having kind of dreams and visions.
They miss one of the great rules of the best filmmakers. Hitchcock was well known for this, and I think one of the best directors to use it in more modern times is Christopher Nolan, is not showing what it is you're most afraid of. You know, everybody's CG happy now, and I like some great CG and some great special effects, but for you to actually pull away and not show something and then let the audience fill it in, the fear of the unknown, mm-hmm. not the fear of something that's right in front of you, that would have been a whole lot better. That's what makes the book work so well, is that they're referring to these sounds they're hearing back in the background. You know, mm-hmm. I think they might be climbing up the side of the ship. You don't know who they are, but it's capitalized, and that's scary. And that's what would have made it work. Okay, maybe you do some special effects, but just to have the smoke swirling around and then congealing into these ghostly figures, mm-hmm. like the Pirates of the Caribbean ride or something, it's not scary. It's mm-hmm. it's just flashy. And even from the perspective of the story the film was trying to tell, it didn't make any sense. Some stuff you think of just kind of swirls around and then whooshes around the ship. And then maybe someone with a more powerful imagination like Edmund dreamed up the sea serpent.
Which is actually real.
Physical and has to be killed. The boss? Yeah, it's actually real.
Yeah, you know, how come that Edmund's is – how come his dream is not just a wisp of smoke? And I kind of imagined, and I probably – I don't know. I might have gone this direction, maybe a little less – maybe a little more visual, but it wouldn't have been, you know, wisps of smoke in the shape of people, you know. And even Rince, you know, he sees his wife, and I'm thinking, wait, his wife, is it worth nightmare? No, really?
Yeah, what's that about? Your darkest wishes? I mean, it's not, there's no continuity there.
Yeah.
Okay, is it showing your worst nightmare, or is it showing the dreams that you can't have, you know?
Yeah.
What exactly is it trying to do, and how is that tempting?
Yeah, so Caspian, you know, his father tells him he's disappointed in him, and that I didn't really mind so much. But I'm kind of thinking, wait, that's his worst nightmare, really? That's the very worst that he. But it's
in case of emergency, break glass. You know, like in Inception, where they say, hey, "How are we going to get to this guy?" Well, we gotta go for the father relationship. You know, it makes more sense in the plot of that film.
Yeah.
But here it's like, yeah, grab for father issues. You know, out of the blue. Why?
There aren't really that many character arcs in the film. It's more like little character moments where, oh, we'll do this little development mm-hmm. here, you know, or this little twist here. Let's talk about before we talk about the fight with the sea serpent, what did you think of Edmund and the witch at this point? I mean, what do you think
the worst part?
What do you think they were saying about Edmund's character as well?
Summary, not the worst part of the film, but completely needless and just familiar territory. Peter did this whole thing back in Prince Caspian.
Yeah.
The witch tempting him and all that. And that was questionable enough, but it was Edmund who took care of the witch. And it was like, okay, this has come full circle now. Edmund has conquered the witch. He doesn't have any power over him anymore.
Exactly, yeah.
Now we're right back around to the same thing. It's a retread, and it's completely needless for the story that even the film was trying to tell about Edmund, not much less the book's story about him. It's internally inconsistent, even with the other films, to say nothing of the inconsistency with the book.
Yeah, inconsistency, with the second film. I mean, that was one of those, subtle character developments with Edmund, where there's nothing stated. You know, Lucy doesn't have to say, oh, Edmund, you just broke the ice of the witch. That must mean that you're free from her hold now. You know, you didn't have to have that. You could kind of pick up on it just from him mm-hmm. breaking the ice. And here it's sort of, really? You know, that, okay, we're back to this? Yeah, unnecessary and just, it's like they just can't get away from Tilda Swinton as part of it. And I had a dream.
Did it come to life?
Did not come true. But I met Tilda Swinton in my dream, and I came up to her, and I gave her an independent clause ending with a comma but not continuing with the rest of it, where I said, I absolutely loved seeing you in The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and could not have picked a better actress. But I hated seeing you in the second three films, you know? Especially the third. Ooh. I didn't say that, but I wanted to in my dream, and I was polite. But that's kind of how I felt here. I said, oh, it's not necessary. But no, moving on, we have more to talk about. Okay, what did you think of the fight with the sea serpent? The way it was done, what did you actually think of it?
From a few perspectives. It was a good fight in terms of from what I remember, that the effects, you know, everything was choreographed.
You saw where
I never
the money
felt
went.
The sea serpent was fake.
Saw where the money went.
Yes, it was all there, and the time as well. You got to have your giant battle at the end. You know, so we can't hurl all kinds of massive computer program generated armies at each other. So instead, we're going to have this massive sea serpent. And as a fight, I mean, I always knew the sea serpent fight was going to be drawn out.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't say I was unhappy with the amount of time taken with it, but it did do a few things similar to what happened in the book. I mean, you know, looping around the ship and all of that.
That was one of the few moments where my heart actually leapt, and it was actually intense. And I thought, oh, wow.
Yes.
You know.
Yes, you actually thought, okay, it's going to bust the ship into a million pieces, and that's it. It did, that part did work. The rest of it kind of blurs together in my mind. I feel almost about it like the very end of the last Pirates of the Caribbean movie, at World's End or whatever it's called. I don't even remember the title very well, but I did see it in theaters, and it was just, I just remember a lot of ships crashing into each other and debris blowing up and tentacles, you know, going all over the place and storms and whirlpools, and they just poured everything into it. And when everything is loud and fantastic, nothing is, because it's all crescendo and there's no quiet moments. And as we know, they did have, you know, the quiet moments of with Eustace that we'll talk about later. But I just don't remember a whole lot about it. And of course, it's very hard to root for the characters based on the past hour and 15 minutes of the film.
I mean, you had so much just seemed forced to me, whether it was the dialogue between Reepy Cheep and Eustace. On the when he was trying to fly away, it also took away from Eustace's character when he needed that coaxing to go back. Whereas in the book, when he fought the sea serpent, he didn't need coaxing. Reepy Chief mm-hmm. didn't need to tell him to be brave. You know,
yeah.
Be an adrenaline.
Look how great
be an
you
adrenaline
are.
Junkie.
Look how powerful you are.
Yeah. You're this amazing person. You're extraordinary. You didn't need. You had. It's just. Yeah, I can point to little things that I liked. There was little moments where I thought this was genuinely intense, and you know, it's doing what it's succeeding where it's trying to succeed. As an action sequence in certain places, but the book's emphasis was so ironic, really. It was literally ironic, where you had Reepy Cheep saying, don't fight, push. And it's everything, so much of it just seems forced. And yeah, it's all kind of running together in my head, but... Yeah, I think you pretty much said everything about the fight that I would have said.
Well, do you want to say everything that I would have said about the next item?
The albatross?
Oh, Oh.
Okay. I'll start, and then if I didn't say anything, okay. This is one of those moments that I actually, as I knew the films were coming out, I actually put quite a bit of thought visually, put a lot of visual energy into how I would have scenes turn out. And the scene with the albatross, I actually even had a selection of music picked out too.
Which was?
Do you remember where the scene where Gandalf and the Rohirrim in the Two Towers charge down the cliff?
One of the most beautiful moments of the film.
Listen to that piece of music. That was my music in my head for when the albatross came. Because at first it said it looked like a cross, then it looked like a plane, and then you saw it was an albatross. And I imagined this really soft moment where the albatross was going to speak to Lucy. And here it's like the fans are going, oh, look, the albatross. Where'd it go? You know, it's like, oh, a bird, you know, don't shoot it. I mean, she says, oh, Aslan, you know, help us. And the albatross comes, and there's no indication that the albatross is Aslan. It's like a slap in the face to fans. Here's your fan moment. Boom. You know, it's like, here's your stone knife. Next, now to our next magical trick. You know, there's no significance to it.
But when the emphasis of the film's storyline is Aslan's kind of around to help these people do what they're supposed to do because they're the amazing thing and they're the ones who are supposed to run around and pick up the props.
Aslan helps those people.
Are awesome, and Aslan is the sidekick, then it makes perfect sense.
Aslan is the sidekick. That's right. That's a good way of putting it. Aslan helps those who help themselves.
It's very similar. The word I've used before is Pelagian. It's that fancy term that just means, you know, God is here to help you, and that's God's favorite thing to do in the world is help you. He's got nothing in it for himself.
All the best you can be.
Yeah, exactly. It's very American, although I wouldn't say that Americans made it up. It's just man-made religion, and I don't expect the Chronicles of Narnia film to behave, you know, to endorse every element of Christianity. You know, this is a secular film. They shouldn't have the Voyage of the Dawn Treader book in front of them and then beside it, the Bible. But if they had followed the book, they could have just gotten a much better story. So it just seems like they'd be shooting themselves in the foot. And Lewis showed Aslan as this amazing savior who had his own agenda, who had his own reason for drawing these children into Narnia to make them into something great. Not that they were great on their own. In this case, of course, that's completely flip-flopped. And it almost, for the story they were trying to tell, why even show the albatross? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a cameo. And people who haven't read the book or who have read the book and don't remember that part for whatever reason, they just go like, what? What was that about? That was strange.
And you know, also, in the book, it's scarier. Why? Because you realize pretty quickly they've been trying to get out of the Dark Island longer than they've been trying to get in. Longer than it took them to find the Roop. So you know pretty quickly that it's not going to let them escape, and so it's more hopeless. Here, you know they have a fighting chance. Mm-hmm. Why? Because you've been watching the entire movie.
Yeah, well, it's like kind of that example of, you know, you're trying to get across the chasm and you're doing all you can to get across the chasm. This is a Christian evangelism thing, by the way, for people who don't know. And then along comes somebody to help you, you know, and you know, you've like gotten halfway across the chasm and then he helps you get the rest of the way across. Well, whatever you think of that from a theological point of view, doesn't it make the story more amazing if, like, you haven't even gotten halfway across? You know, like, you cannot do anything to save yourself. And that's the way it was in the book. And it would have made it so much better. Mm-hmm. Maybe they thought, that's a deus ex machina. You know, we're pulling the God character out of the machine to do something at the last moment. But it could have worked. I'm sure they could have made it work.
Oh, yeah. I think they really could have made it work. Could have made it very intense. Mm-hmm. Okay, quick side note. I have been racking my brain, and I cannot think of what it is that makes Rindon turn blue. Can you?
J.R.R. Tolkien, if you want my honest opinion.
Oh, yes, of course. These were made on the tail of the success of Lord of the Rings. How could I have been so stupid? Next.
Well, I don't really understand. I still don't understand why it glowed blue, though, because orcs were not near.
No.
I mean, that's what Sting is supposed
maybe,
to do. And Glamdring also, if I remember
them
correctly.
Maybe one of them had read Tolkien, and that was his worst fear. We just didn't see them because they spent all the budget on the sea serpent. So they didn't have time to render the orcs.
They could have used an orc. It's already been designed. They could just toss him in there, you know, pay a slight royalty to Weta Digital. And
Richard
and then
Taylor
that takes
comes
care of that.
Up and puts his orc on the Dawn Treader.
He would have been a good orc, though, if he was on the
Richard
Dawn Treader.
Richard Taylor impression. Thank you very much.
Ah, yes. Yeah, okay. Golf clap. Golf clap. Like,
thank you.
Right
thank
now.
You.
There we go.
I'll give my king wave from The Princess Bride and the King's Speech. All this time, we've been getting little breathers to the Undragony, and we're not really going to discuss the significance there, but we do have Eustace dropped onto the island, and he has the sword. Why does he have the sword? Because Roop threw it into Eustace, and I don't know, never mind the fact that he's throwing a sword into their friend. They just, no, don't lose the sword! But he gets the sword back to the island, and then Eustace faces his greatest battle. Fighting
the
off
the green mist is there too.
Fighting off the green mist. I thought I was watching this and I thought, is this really happening? Really? You know, I felt like the little kid on YouTube, like David after the dentist, you know? I felt like, is this real life? Is this going to be forever?
I almost, if you had not mentioned it, I would not have remembered the green mist swirling there, too. It's like, oh, no, it's trying to stop me. It's trying to tickle my skin.
What's it going to do? What's it going to do? You know, I mean, really, what would it do to him? Kidnap him? Because it doesn't kill people, apparently.
No, maybe maybe you have to have a greater concentration of green mist to swarm, you know, and so that it can teleport one of the little robots. Or my question is whether this in this close proximity, this close in proximity to the Dark Island, I wonder if Eustace could have done the same trick. I mean, this would have been just a great little, you know, surprise twist. It's like, oh yeah, they can do that. Genius script writing here. If Eustace had totally said in his mind, my worst and greatest fear is a vacuum cleaner. My worst and greatest fear is a vacuum cleaner. And then, kajam, one just appears out of the green mist, and he takes this smoky, misty vacuum cleaner and sucks up all the green mist. Ha ha. Ha ha. Wow. Oh, yeah. There we go. There would have been applause in that theater tonight.
You know there would have been. You know that. Oh.
Folks, can you feel the snark tonight? Just a little. Oh. Please humor me as I humor myself.
Golf clap, golf clap.
Why, thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Oh. Okay, so he's teleported, if we have the transporter beam sound effect from Star Trek also, really, maybe we could put that in here.
Well, don't forget, it's also the visual, it's also the beam of lightning, or beam of light from the Return of the King movie, where it shoots up from Minas Morgul.
Yeah, and really no reason why. I mean, is there a history to these swords? What magical land were they forged in? Are they swords from Aslan's country? Are they swords from Telmar? What's that about? Why are these swords magic swords? The thing is, if you're trying to do fantasy shtick, you need to at least have a backstory, a believable backstory for it. And even for the story they're trying to tell, it doesn't make sense. It's like, what? I guess somebody figures, it's fantasy. You can do anything. No, you can't, actually. Fantasy has rules, like any good genre should.
Yeah, and that leads to me. Okay, to take another off. Point. Okay, so the green mist goes away. Which, okay, I'm not going to bash that too much, because in one of the versions Lewis did, the green mist does. Well, not green mist. I'm already corrupted. The dark island does just go away.
And right, and we might want to comment for readers that I'm trying to remember which version came first, but someone thought, hey, you know, I want to change this. Or maybe he thought later, I want to change it. So there's two different versions.
Yes,
there really are.
There was the British edition, and then Lewis made, and you, I mean, some people say, oh, it's the American edition. But Lewis did actually write the change. In the British edition, the Dark Island goes away and there's a line saying, and they realize there had been nothing to fear of all along. Whereas mm-hmm. in the American edition, they escape from the Dark Island, but it's still there. And there's more of this idea that everything was actually real. You know, that it was actually a real threat and that they might have mm-hmm. actually died there, perhaps. Also, yes. It is a difference.
I still – go ahead.
Well, there's a difference also in the line. In the British edition, I believe, Roop says, promise to never let's see. Here, you talk. I'll look to see which one he says.
I was just going to say that I still haven't decided which one I like better. Do I like the Dark Island destroyed, or do I like to think it's still out there somewhere, you know? Because there are real fears in the world, mm-hmm. and that's true. And yet – it's also great to say that when Aslan is involved, there really is nothing to be afraid of. But at the same time, it is out there and our fears are real. So see the catch there. I don't know which one I would
British
like better.
In the British edition, also, Roop says, grant me a boon, promise to never bring me back there. Which mm-hmm. I think is kind of a ridiculous thing to ask. You know, I promise you'll never bring me back. You know, why would they bring him back? Please, you say this. Don't take
me back. Okay, I need to nitpick that just a little bit, because he's been on this island where dreams, bad dreams, horrors have been soaking his head for however long. And you'd think he was, I mean, at first, for example, he's saying, mercy, mercy. He suspects them. He thinks that they're going to be a dream. And it's really hard to get rid of those thought patterns. So
I never questioned
why he said that.
Okay, fair enough. Mm-hmm. But in the second edition, he basically just says, promise that you'll never ask me what happened. And you know, Caspian says he'll never ask. You know,
makes sense. Yeah. So, because you think about it from the perspective of a combat veteran or something who's seen horrible things and just doesn't want to go on about them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So... Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then you have a bunch of robots appear, and apparently the Green Mist has done a fantastic job of keeping these people well fed. Or, I don't know.
Also, the Dawn Treader is like the TARDIS from Doctor Who, where the inside is bigger than the outside, and you can just pile all those people in Dawn Treader, or tie them with ropes so they can just run along behind the ship as they're rowing or sailing back mm-hmm. to Narnia.
Yeah,
I'm just not sure this plan was well thought out.
It's that element of realism, you know, I talked about before, how, and I think this was in the last podcast, Jim Fan and I were talking about it, how the movie just skips over certain things that, you know, the dragon is pulling the Dawn Treader, you know. Whereas in the book, they thought, boy, how would we feed him? How would he fly? Because he certainly couldn't just rest on the Dawn Treader. He's too big. He couldn't fly forever. You know, little elements of realism. Because, again, these are chronicles. He writes them as if they're actual pieces of history. Mm-hmm. You know, yes, they're condensed.
And that is how...
written for children. But he writes them with that, I think it's the right word, gravitas.
Mm-hmm. And another word, look it up in the dictionary, is verisimilitude.
That's true.
If you're the more fantastic you're making a story, the more you need to ground it in reality. That's why you need characters either directly from our world or characters of that world who act in some way similar to people in our world. You need some kind of anchor point of reference for an audience member or reader to sit there and say, hey, yeah, I could be like that. And that way you are drawn into that world. Mm-hmm. Your imagination can run wild with the impossible while you're grounded in the possible.
Right.
And Lewis did that so well, even with his inclusion of little rules like, you know, you don't ride a centaur, you don't ride a unicorn, mm-hmm. you know, marsh wiggles eat eels and have different recipes for eels, that kind of mm-hmm. thing. Yeah. So much more so with Professor Tolkien, who gets a few credits in this film. one could say there's just so much about Middle Earth that feels real because there's reference points to this world. And this completely ignores that. I mean, if earlier they were trying to avoid a deus ex machina with the albatross, because that wouldn't seem realistic. I mean, give them the benefit of the doubt there, but then here they go and do this thing here. That's not well thought out either. You know, how are they going to get all these people back? And who's been feeding them? You know, where have they been sleeping? They've been in suspended animation the whole time, and lost in some kind of void space. I mean, they could have at least thrown out some kind of partial explanation, like, where have they been? Wow, that's a mystery for another time. But you can just tell that that wasn't thought out, even for the story they were trying to tell.
Well, I mean, this just says who we are as Donnie Webbers, that we can rant about this. But Doctor, I'm about to set you loose and unchain you on perhaps one of the most significant pieces in this film. Right afterwards, Lucy, not just another character, but Lucy says, "We did it. I knew we could." And then you have Edmund saying, "I don't think," he says, "it wasn't just us." And then the camera pans to Eustace, who was just, of course, dropped in the water. We don't know how he got there. He just appears.
Another transporter beam. But I guess.
Tell us, why is this a significant element in the film?
It's significant because the Chronicles of Narnia, unlike other stories, think higher than just showing how great people can be. That's humanism. If I weren't a Christian, I'd like humanism. It has some good points to it, but it completely ignores the fact that people are not of themselves special just because they happened to be born. A lot of stories act as if that's true. You're special just because you're born. You know, like everyone is. And many people, when I said that, immediately thought of the classic line from the Pixar film The Incredibles, where Dash, a little boy, his mom tells him, "Everyone's special, Dash." And he says, "Well, that's another way of saying no one is." And if everyone is special, then no one is. And for a film, as any kind of story, to spend all this time talking about how special these characters are, they're just special because you exist. You're special. First, it's cliche. That was Glumpuddle's big argument when we were talking about the scene where Lucy says the beautifying spell and then, you know, has her "It's a Wonderful Life" thing. Uh-huh. We talked a lot about that. And his big point, and really we don't need to say much more beyond this, is it's just cliche. It's just a good, safe moral to utter in a movie or story, where nobody's going to sit there and go, "Huh, I totally disagree with that. You know, we should all try to be somebody else and not be ourselves." Who's going to say that? You know, it's like saying, "Yeah, well,
it's
we
like
really
Lucy
should have
saying,
earthquakes."
I wish I were like you.
Yeah.
Sorry.
And then, oh my goodness, and that's another contradiction. No, Lucy. You know, let's lecture Lucy about, no, Lucy, you need to be yourself and let the MLG be the MLG. First, you can't be consistent about it anyway, but. Well, it's cliche. One's cliche. Two, you can't be consistent with that because even in humanism, we're all trying to be better than we are. And three, for Narnia, it is not who the children are themselves inside, deep down, good people. It is what Aslan is making them to be. He did not choose Peter, Susan, Edmund, and Lucy because they were great kings and queens material. We factually don't know why he chose them. He made them into great kings and queens material. And they spend the rest of their lives dedicated to Aslan or whoever he is in the other world, their world. And we'll get to that in a future podcast, Aslan's Land at the end. But here, it just completely takes the credit off of Aslan, who we at least saw as a cameo. And instead, it's Eustace. Oh, wow. You know, Eustace being a dragon was the best thing that could have happened to us. He saved the whole thing. Who'd have thunk it? You know, it's just that usual, not well thought out, you know, underdog thing. Well, the underdog saves us all. Whereas in the book, it had a much powerful story. Eustace was a jerk until his outer appearance mimicked his inner appearance, and then Aslan had to save him. Mm-hmm. You know,
yeah.
And they just
and
this line shows
next,
that either
that ties
either,
into the next episode too,
right. And this exchange here, as I'm sure you're about to agree, just shows that they don't understand that this isn't about, you know, people power here. Power to the people. Wow, you know, even the little guy can change the course of existence. That's a great message, but it gets a little old and cliched, and it's just it's not like Narnia.
Yeah.
People see that and they go, something's off there, even if they don't know what. You know,
yeah,
you can put the chains back on and I'll try to sit in my corner and be quiet and click my chains. Thank you.
No, my jaw just dropped. I thought, yes, they got it. They got it. Wait, what? What? It was kind of like the albatross. Oh, yes. What? Where'd he go? The moment was here. I had a moment. And
it's a great big head fake.
Yes.
Yeah.
And now Glumpuddle, he actually took it deeper. He saw it as a personal offense.
Hard not to think that way,
that
because who could be so stupid as to change
that,
it? Yeah.
They were trying to make the fans think, oh, yes, we're talking about Aslan. Boom, gotcha. We're actually talking about Eustace. And I know
because that line is from the book. The main point to recognize here is that Edmund or whoever it is, someone in the book does say, I don't think – no, Lucy says, I don't think it was us.
Yeah, Lucy says it.
What she means is that the albatross has disappeared. And, you know, no one ever sees it again.
And we know who the albatross was very clearly in the book. Mm-hmm. And whereas here, for three, some people have said, well, I think they could have still been talking about Aslan. It's not, they don't say that they're talking about Eustace. Here's three reasons why. First of all, we don't ever hear that the albatross was Aslan. There's no indication in the movie that the albatross is Aslan. Second, the albatross doesn't do anything. We very clearly see them defeat the sea serpent. And third, the camera goes right to Eustace. I mean, probably one of the few subtle moments in the film. Like, hey, here's the time to use subtlety.
And maybe a fourth reason why we know that they're talking about Eustace is just that that's been the pattern throughout the film is that, you know, Aslan's here to help these people do it. I sound a bit derisive by saying these people, but not like people are stupid or clueless or something, but that's just not what the Narnia stories
are
about.
Robots, Dr. Ransom. What's wrong with you? Robots made this film.
That could be why. Well, I don't know if I go so far as to say that, you know, the scriptwriters are doing it on purpose. It feels like they did, because it was so clearly started out as a reference to the book, and then they just took it in a completely different direction. It feels like it was intentional, and maybe that's how they read the book. Maybe that's how, hey, it's just a bunch of, you know, empty shells here doing what Aslan is supposed to do. We got to fix this. If that's the attitude you have, then you're telling a completely different story. Mm-hmm. And we're back to the same thing, where not only are they failing to uphold the themes of the book, which, you know, okay, that's their goal, but even as a story in itself, the film fails so many times because it's internally flawed.
Right. Well, this definitely, I'm going to do something painful. I'm going to have to put a stop on this. We're going to have to continue in another episode.
That's okay. I was getting all depressed. So I appreciate the
fortunately, your dreams did not come true on this podcast. You still have a wonderful wife, and you can be encouraged.
That's true. You see, Lucy, you really had a wonderful life.
Well, what do you mean you saved me? Well, I saved you via jumping in the water, and you wouldn't have saved you, and that's how I saved you. That's how I saved you.
Excellent.
That's Merry Christmas, Clarence.
That is an awesome,
Jimmy. Beat down, broken, leaky house.
That is a wonderful imitation of the late, great Jimmy Stewart.
Thank you very much.
I applaud thee, sir. I applaud thee again.
That's what I love about Jimmy Stewart. You know, he's so upbeat. They could have put in this movie, well, would you look at that? It's a big sea serpent. Oh, my goodness. It's just beautiful. I've never seen anything so magnificent. Come, everybody. Look over to the side of the ship.
Okay, I'm closing my eyes. I'm picturing him in one of those suits in black and white with the hat on the deck of the ship while everything's color in 3D around him. And it works. It totally works.
Doggone it, he took out the mask.
Oh, you should get some comments for that. Oh,
I probably will. Okay.
That, well, I can't think of a better way to end there, that little fantasy.
I can't either.
But first we have the Stay Puffed Marshmallow Man in the middle of the island. Now we have Jimmy Stewart on deck.
Oh, yes. And Eustace vacuuming up. That's a wonderful image. I'm gonna have some good dreams tonight.
Should I make a special request to somebody out there who is on spring break and has some spare time? Just make a Photoshop image of Eustace with, you know, like a Auric XL vacuum cleaner or something sucking up the green mist. I wouldn't pay you anything, but you'd have my eternal gratitude.
Ditto. Well, this has been fun. This was fun.
I'd like to point out that it's not a very pleasant task to find fault with the film. Both of us really wanted to like this film. Glumpuddle wanted to like it. All the fans who now can't like it, if they're honest with themselves, wanted to like it. I just can't. I mean, it had some places, but yeah. So it has been fun, though, to talk about it.
And I would like to point out that while it's been fun to talk about it, neither Dr. Ransom and I are abusing any kind of substance or on any kind of narcotics or anything whatsoever. We're like,
No, this is true. Even though I was coughing a few times, that's just because my mouth got dry because I was rambling and didn't have any water nearby.
And now
I
wasn't it sounds smoking like you're making anything. Excuses.
We are a family-friendly podcast.
We are a family-friendly podcast.
We obey all the
podcast.
Laws of our country.
Yes, there is no Jack Daniels. There is nothing that makes us laugh other than good old fun. So
no, those things are just said for the purpose of comedy and satire.
Yes, satire, one of the lost arts.
It's been brought to you by the letters N and W. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, Doctor, thank you very much.
Thank you, O Podcasting Prince. And I guess I look forward to dealing with the Sword of Undragoning and the Sword of Aslan's Country.
All right. And... oh, my mind just froze here. I had some kind of witty exit.
Okay.
Anyway.
Keep rolling.
We'll just keep going. Keep thinking of something. Yes. Further up and further in. Thanks for joining us.
Further up.
For joining
up
me.
And further in.
Thank you for joining me.
I'm glad to join you. Further up and further in.
Oh, boy.
We just got tripped all over ourselves in the last there.
It's okay.
I'm almost picturing Jimmy Stewart versus the Stay Pump, Marshmallow Man.
Yeah.
Wow.
Oh.
Oh, what a bad movie. Oh, I liked Megamind better. I really did like Megamind better